to match politically correct standards.
Yes, exactly. Now, by the way, who is George Washington?
George who? George Washington is a town in Washington State. It's about 90 miles from here. So, anyway. Avi, why don't you give your website, and we'll go from there.
Okay, the website is vicmord.com. In other words, half of Victor, V-I-C, half of Mordecai, M-O-R-D.com. And I also have an 800 number for my books, 1-800-540-0828, 1-800-540-0828.
1-800-540-0828, VicMoore.com. You know what makes me very nervous is we're sitting here right in the same studio. How many years ago now? 4 years ago, 1 month before 9-1-1, you were saying that terrorists would be flying airplanes into buildings.
And I was saying this already 15 years ago.
What, because of what you heard?
Exactly. They were saying this every day. Every day. In Arabic, in their media, and nobody listened.
It's in the Jihad in America video, by the way.
Right, I remember that.
And that was shown in 94. But again, Bill Clinton suppressed it. And
but here we are, the middle of summer, and we're we're talking about another big bang, right?
Oh, yes. That's what we think, too.
You know why he's saying that? Because everybody thought Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. Everybody thought he had biological and chemical.
No, I'm not talking
and
about...
Saddam Hussein, no, that's hyperbole. In other words, Saddam Hussein wanted the people...
Who said... I want to ask you. Who said that Saddam Hussein didn't have nuclear weapons? He did. He had opened the border from Syria and Iraq just after... when he knew that America is going to go in.
All the way from 96, he was... Abu Kamal.
Avi, I'm sure we saw trucks, big trucks, going from Iraq to Syria. And it was really unusual, really unusual. No connection between Iraq and Syria was, no economy, no any kind of merchandise coming on the border. And here, suddenly, we have big trucks going from Iraq to Syria. And we don't know what is in these trucks. And I'm sure that this nuclear weapon went to Syria with the Saddam Hussein people, that they are in Syria.
Right. So we knew the trucks were crossing over.
I am sure. I have seen these trucks, and it was something unusual for me.
Interesting. But understanding that the American people, to go back to the earlier thing, the Americans tend to be a little more left-brain Westerners.
Yeah.
And they see these expressions coming from the Middle East as being more emotional but having no real substance. That's what they see. Well, we'll blow up America. We'll do this. We'll kill all the Europeans.
But here.
And
here.
Everybody goes, well, okay, yeah, that's a little overstated.
That's what they said about Hitler and Mein Kampf.
Right. That's why I'm asking how much of that is hyperbole and how much of it is real.
I can give you a percentage. It's like you have 97%.
Of
what they said they are going to do. They will do, because they have people everywhere, and every person has a position to do the job.
Right.
We can't imagine how much satanic mind they have. This
the views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online Audience Participation Center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. And when you do check us out on the web at freedom21santacruz.net, one thing that you definitely want to look at is the Understanding Sustainable Development, a Guide for Public Officials. And it's probably one of the most important documents that if you want to learn all about what's going on with sustainable development, it's a great place to start. There's also, and I'm just going to read this real quick, it's America's being transformed from the land of the free to the land of the controlled via mechanisms that target the middle class. Knowing reality, the threat, and the potential is the foundation for restoring and preserving liberty. And if you, Michael Shaw and the folks here just put together a radio series from the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio entitled The War on Reason, and it's featuring talks on abolishing private property by Dr. Michael Kaufman. Just a bunch of folks on there, so you know, go to the web, check it out, pick that stuff up, and you'll be better armed. And you talk about being better armed, hold on to your hat, because our next guest is going to talk about things that even at the conference in Reno, people who are seasoned folks in, you know, fighting sustainable development were just blown away by her presentation. Our guest is Dr. Madeline Cosman. Dr. Cosman is an attorney known for her work in medical law. She's the president of the Medical Equity, Inc., located in San Diego, California. She's been a speaker for medical meetings and bar associations, and she's written books, and she's just an amazing woman. Madeline, are you there?
I'm very much here. It's a pleasure to work with you.
Oh, the pleasure is really mine. I've been looking forward to talking to you again after our wonderful conversations and listening to you at Reno.
Terrific.
For our listeners, talk about what your presentation was at Reno.
The name of the presentation was Sustainable Medicine. And very few people know about sustainable medicine here, even among physicians. In fact, most physicians know nothing about it. But people in Europe know a great deal. And if any one of our listeners wants to go onto Google, just try putting in the two words, sustainable medicine, and you'll get something extraordinary, something like 5,850,000 references, because sustainable medicine is the attempt by the Agenda 21 proponents to completely transform our ideas of high-tech scientific medicine, and particularly to eliminate certain important high-tech medical devices and techniques. And I used, just as an example, the extraordinary medical plastics that we're all accustomed to seeing, the little plastic tubes that are used for breathing tubes or for renal dialysis or for cardiac catheterization or for feeding tubes or for blood transfusions. The flexible plastic is so common in hospital rooms and in emergency treatment that we take it completely for granted. But 50 years ago, this did not exist. The only type of tubings were made of either metal or perhaps glass or ceramic, and therefore, of course, they were painful to install.
Hold on to that thought. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. We're back with Dr. Madeline Cosman talking about sustainable medicine, which is usually when we hear sustainable, it's not really sustainable. Continue, please.
Certainly. In any event, those who want to see sustainable medicine essentially say that high-tech medicine is impossible for everyone to have because it's too expensive and it's inappropriately distributed. Therefore, no one shall have it. And as an example, the beautiful, intelligent, actually ingenious flexible plastics that are used throughout medicine and surgery and have actually saved the lives of, without exaggeration, billions of people worldwide. These plastics, which are treated with a particular chemical called phthalate, are being banned throughout the world. Greenpeace, a group called Healthcare Without Harm, and various rather leftist radical environmentalist groups have said that these plastics, namely the phthalate-treated plastics used in medicine, which have been used, examined, and tested for at least 50 years.
And in all kinds of areas, right? I mean, with kids and troops in battle and just in all kinds of uses.
Exactly. That is, every time one sees an ambulance, there are flexible plastics within it. Every time one sees a roadside accident, the people have the tubes for breathing or intravenous fluids that are made out of these marvelous, ingenious flexible plastics, which are PVC tubes treated with phthalate. Well, a little bit of phthalate leaches out into the bloodstream, but it harms no one. But Greenpeace has maintained that it could possibly harm some people, therefore it shall be used for no one. This is the old precautionary principle. If there is any possible risk, there shall be no action, which of course makes any sort of invention, any sort of creativity, any sort of production impossible, because everything is ordinarily risk and balance. But if they start by saying there shall be no risk, then of course there can be no benefit. In any event, what they have said is that phthalates leach out into the bloodstream, and they have tested this on, if you please, rats and alligators. And they found that the poor little rats and the poor little alligators with huge amounts of phthalates...
Hold on, we're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Madeline Cosman about the ridiculous notion of sustainable medicine. Please continue.
You're absolutely right that this is ridiculous, and your listeners will recognize precisely how ridiculous when I tell you that the experiments that had been done, not on people, because for people there's no problem whatsoever, but the experiments had been done on rats and alligators, and apparently the rats and the alligators had shriveled penises. Therefore, they were worried, Greenpeace and Doctors for Sustainable Development were worried that this might be the effect upon little boys. Therefore, because infants, prenatal, or I should say the neonatal rescue tubes used for these premature infants might conceivably affect the genitalia of baby boys, this is reason to eliminate the flexible plastics from all of medicine and surgery.
When
now,
they do these
crazy
kind of tests on the animals, don't they expose them to more than any human being could possibly be exposed to over a lifetime?
Absolutely. And not only do they do that, but in fact, the Surgeon General has said phthalates are safe. The FDA has said phthalates are safe. But the Environmental Protection Agency has said, ha-ha, maybe phthalates are carcinogens, and maybe they will harm the testes of infant boys.
Maybe.
In which case, get rid of them. Now, this is crazy, but Baxter International, which creates about 500 million of these PVC plus phthalate-treated tubes and medical bags every year, Baxter has caved in to this political pressure. And this is a disaster for medicine and surgery. It's a disaster for the patients because there's no equally good, equally tested, and affordable substitute.
So what's going to happen?
Pardon me?
What's going to happen?
Well, they're looking for a substitute, but, and in fact in Europe there are some substitutes, but it is highly likely that these substitutes, which have not been anywhere as well tested and as examined, are going to prove to be, under the precautionary principle, potentially dangerous, in which case they also will be banned. The basic intent is not simply to get rid of these plastics, although I shouldn't really say that so easily, because there are several groups that, in fact, are dedicating themselves to ridding the world of all plastics. There's a group called Physicians for Social Responsibility, which includes phthalates in what they call the 12 most toxic chemicals on the planet. Well, Roy, that's just a hysterical, ridiculous comment. And there's another group called the International Society of Doctors for the Environment. These are, for the most part, people who maintain that there really is no difference between you, me, as human beings, and long-fingered salamanders and oak trees. And if a polar bear is going to be endangered by something that is done to you or to me, well, the polar bear may be more significant than either of us. And this is a view of the universe that is totally antagonistic to reason, as well as against the Judeo-Christian tradition, as well as against civilization of humankind. But the important point is, number one, under sustainable medicine, the intent is to get rid of, eliminate, essentially destroy the high-tech medical product. But there's something worse, and that is to get rid of the high-tech medical ideas, and therefore instill in all human beings, if you please, a duty to die. Now, I know this may sound ridiculous and absurd, but I can tell you that there are several people who are very important in the sustainable medicine movement, among whom is a Dr. Daniel Callahan, who is the head of the Hastings Institute in New York, who has such book titles as False Hopes, Setting Limits, What Kind of Life? Or The Troubled Dream of Life. What he says is that sustainable medicine must redefine what it means to have good health and long life. It's impossible to pay for high-tech everything for everyone. It's too expensive. It's inequitable. Therefore, there shall be no high-tech medicine for anyone. If a person reaches a particular age, there shall be no more treatment. If a person has lived to age 75, he's lived long enough. Therefore, he has not only a right to die, but he must revise expectations as to whether he has a right to live. In fact, according to Dr. Callahan and those in the sustainable medicine ideology, each individual has a duty to die. And what they say, or often refer to, is we must study environmental equity. Consider the beautiful polar bear who catches fish in the Arctic. Now, surely no polar bear would ever presume to hop on a plane to retire in sunny Florida and collect Social Security. The polar bear would never burn valuable fossil fuel, and the polar bear knows that he can't fish for himself in warm water, but selfish human snowbirds from New York and Minnesota, they fly south to live a brutish old age and burden Medicare and Social Security and the environment and the global budget. Well, this is quite ridiculous, but in fact, those who believe in sustainable medicine believe that human beings are only one strand in nature's beautiful web, And we're not an important strand, we're just an ordinary strand. And therefore we deserve no more long life, no more attention, no more lavishing of medicine and surgery upon us than would be so for any polar bear or dog or horse or salamander, or for that matter, cauliflower or squash.
I'm just speechless.
This
is incredible. How did you get into this? I mean, I know you've been, you know, you're an attorney and, you know, you've done a lot of work and your life is going on. Where in this did it come to you?
Well, I will tell you that two people you know well were the ones who, in fact, influenced me in the most benevolent way. Medical law has been my field for about 40 years, and I lecture all over the country, in fact, all over the world, on medical law and medical ethics. And I was giving a lecture at a group at which Michael Shaw and Joanne Nathan were in the audience. And it had nothing to do with sustainable medicine and nothing to do with sustainable development. It was on the criminalization of American medicine. And I was presenting these astonishing facts and cases that I had been involved with, which were totally illogical, in which physicians were being thrown into jail for thoroughly absurd reasons. Patients were being collectivized and viewed as mere members of diagnostic groups as opposed to as individuals. And Michael Shaw and Joanne Nathan said, "This sounds like sustainable development in medicine." And I'm a very intelligent creature, but I must tell you, I didn't know what they were talking about. And at first, I thought, this is bizarre. This makes no sense. But then I started looking for the sustainable medicine documents, and what I discovered, thanks to these magnificent people from Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, was that there was a group of documents that I kept asking for from Geneva, and I finally was able to get them literally from the office of the source in Geneva. And once I read the documents, then I understood that this was a subject that we needed urgently to get to our audiences so that they understand that this is not innocent, that the environmentalism is not simply pertaining to land use, but just as sustainable development is a land grab, it's an attempt to eliminate private property, so sustainable medicine is a body grab. It's an attempt to take from us as individuals the right to decide what shall be done or not done to our bodies.
And in the stuff that you read, what's the ultimate goal?
There is a question. The ultimate goal is to reduce the number of people on the planet. In essence, it is an idea that will ultimately remove people whose quality of life, according to those who are making the decisions, is not worth living. Those who maintain that sustainable medicine is important also maintain that human beings are a burden upon the delicate planet.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. We're back. We're talking to Dr. Madeline Cosman about the unsustainability of sustainable health. Can you tell us, you know, because I'm sure people who are listening are shocked. You know, it's almost unbelievable. How can they see in today's world those practices being implemented?
Well, for one thing, just go to a hospital and ask whether the flexible bags that are used for, say, blood transfusion or medicine administration, or the flexible tubes, are made with phthalates. And if they want to know how to spell it, it's P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E, phthalate. It's this wonderful chemical that's been around for 50 years, and virtually every hospital administrator quakes in his boots whenever you mention the word phthalate, because they most likely have had letters from, or maybe demonstrations from, Greenpeace or the Healthcare Without Harm groups or any of those others I had mentioned, and they know that the phthalates are, that is, the flexible plastics, are in danger. But let me give you a better example. Most people know that in America, as well as other parts of the world, malaria was virtually completely wiped out. How was it wiped out? By one particular magnificent pesticide and chemical, DDT. DDT was virtually safe for people. It harmed virtually no human being. But a particular book in the late 60s called Silent Spring, written by Rachel Carson, was the one book whose basically false research was used by one man, namely William Ruckelshaus of the Environmental Protection Agency, to ban DDT. Ruckelshaus knew that there were, I think it was 93,000 pages, maybe that's not exactly correct, it was some huge number of pages of testimony demonstrating that the DDT chemical was completely safe for human beings. But because of this fallacious, hysterical research done by Rachel Carson, which could not be replicated in a laboratory, but it certainly was replicated by the media in what was in essence a hysterical campaign to eliminate DDT, this one book, one man, and one decision of the EPA in 1972 banned the manufacture and the sale of DDT. Well, DDT is one of the only ways to eliminate the mosquitoes that carry malaria. And there's a wonderful book by one of the other speakers at the Reno event, the Freedom 21 event, and that is Paul Dreesen, and that is called Eco-Imperialism, Green Power and Black Death. And what Paul has brilliantly proved is that...
Hold on just a second. We'll finish that thought right after this break. I'm sorry. Oh, these breaks are killing me. I'm just glued to every word. Then we have to break. But, we're back. We were talking with Dr. Madeline Cosden about just junk science and its effect on our health. Please continue.
The attempt to eliminate DDT was highly successful. And I tend to refer to this as the silent spring technique, because what they did for DDT, they're trying to do for phthalates, they have tried to do for chlorine, and when I say they, I'm referring to those who want sustainable medicine. What they do is follow essentially seven steps. First, they create an emergency by using false and unscientific data. You called it junk science, and you're absolutely correct. Then, number two, they release the information to the media before any scientist can review it. Then third, they generate emotion, and the best emotion is hysteria. And people behave like lunatics, worrying about the thing, whatever it is, in this instance, DDT. Then fourth, they formulate a government plan to ban the chemical. Then they coerce Congress to execute the ban. Then they intimidate the industry to withdraw the product. And then finally, they bully people into rejecting the product, and that's what happened with DDT, and that's what they're trying to do with the phthalates. Well, if you contemplate what is happening in Africa now, recognize that there are 500 million people who in Africa contract malaria, and of these, about 2 million die every year. So tell the people in Kenya and Tanzania, tell the people in various countries of Africa that you don't like DDT because it might injure the eggshells of birds. And these people will say, damn you, I want my child to live, I want to live, I don't want to die of malaria, let us have what will prevent malaria and give us treatments which will cure malaria. Now, what is happening is that environmental groups have essentially affected the World Trade Organizations, the World Banks, the European Union, which refuse to make loans to any country or even buy the produce of any country that uses DDT. Well, just to give you an example, South Africa essentially, in a more polite way, said, screw you to those who refused to give them DDT, and they used DDT. They got rid of malaria, about 90% of all malaria in 3 years.
Wow.
Whereas the neighboring countries, which went along with the environmental ban and do not use DDT, have an increase in malaria. And therefore, if our listeners want to know how sustainable medicine works, DDT and malaria make a superb example.
Where are we on the ban of, and I didn't write the name down.
The phthalates?
Yes.
Unfortunately, we're actually very advanced. The major producer of the phthalate-treated plastics, the medical plastics, is this Baxter International, and they've already caved into the political pressure, and other companies that are number 2, 3, 4 in the world are following. Now, if you ask any physician or you ask any surgeon whether flexible plastic is important in his or her work, you will find that if the individual actually thinks about it, it's absolutely critical, because there's no way that the whole medical enterprise can take place without medical plastics. So, for example, I mentioned before that they're used for oxygen breathing tubes, feeding tubes, cardiac catheters, infant airways, kidney dialysis, intravenous medication, blood transfusion. Imagine if the individual patient has got to be tied to a hospital to get these things and cannot be ambulatory and cannot be living a productive life, what would happen? Recognize what would happen in trauma cases, in automobile accidents, airplane accidents, terrorist attacks. If there is no flexible plastic, the patient cannot have the instantaneous fluids and medications and cannot be stabilized, and therefore most likely will die. So, where are we? Phthalates are being banned, and various hospitals are caving in, just as the manufacturers are caving in. The group called Healthcare Without Harm consists of 41 hospitals and 130 environmental groups. And needless to say, those hospitals that have already signed on to this are stating that they're going to have to charge more for certain procedures. And then the insurance companies are saying, so sorry, there's no money. And what will the end result be? The procedures shall not be done. And then the environmentalists will say, ha-ha, look, we have saved these long-fingered salamanders and those polar bears, and if we had to sacrifice a few thousands or millions of people. Well, so what? They were a nasty burden on the environment anyway.
Isn't there anyone standing up?
Well, I know that I can't be alone.
I hope not.
But upon occasion, I feel very alone. But I'm glad you're there and that our listeners are there. Because really, once people begin to understand this, the humor of it all will be powerful in and of itself as a weapon. That is, when we hear people say, there shall be no plastics used or no flexible plastics used in medicine and surgery because we must protect the testes of infant boys.
Possibly.
Exactly. Possibly because of alligators and rats that have been, whose sex lives perhaps have been interfered with. This is so ludicrous. It is so absolutely preposterous that people will say, we've got to take an action.
Is there any actions being taken that you know?
At the moment, no.
Wow.
No.
Because when you're talking, I don't know about all the, you know, the times that I've been in hospitals and you see, you know, everybody's got that plastic stuff hooked up to them, and then, you know, many seniors are able to, you know, go to the store and, you know, live their lives because they can take their oxygen with them.
Precisely. And according to sustainable medicine, those who are taking their oxygen to the store and living a productive life really should not be any longer alive because their lives, in the judgment of sustainable medicine, are not worth living.
Wow.
I should point out, by the way, that phthalates are used elsewhere, not only in medicine. And our food storage bags, our beauty products, there are PVC toys that are softened with phthalates, car seats for kids, shower curtains, wallpaper, all of these in our homes, our businesses, in our industries have phthalates. But those who hate them want to eliminate them.
Wow, it's crazy. That is just crazy.
It becomes less crazy once we understand the ideas behind the craziness. What sustainable medicine states, that is, this is right from the Rio Declaration on the Environment and Development, 1992, human beings are entitled to a healthy and productive life in harmony with nature. The important point for those who formulated this concept is in harmony with nature. And in 1994, in Cairo, there was something called the Cairo Protocol, which came out of one of the big Agenda 21 meetings in Egypt. The Cairo Protocol states very directly that people burden the environment, and therefore it is necessary to limit the number of people on the earth. One way to do it is to achieve what they call environmental equity. And that means that there must be equity among all species in the environment. And if to do something for a human being is going to injure that polar bear or that oak tree, that's it. Can't happen. It's an astonishing business.
It is.
Now, there are ways that we can get around this. And we have got to actually take very dramatic steps, because if we don't, we are going to recognize that America is actually imitating the European culture of death. What do I mean by culture of death? Some of the people listening may have heard of what is called the Groningen Protocols. This is from Holland. Groningen is a town as well as a big hospital medical center. Groningen Hospital Protocols maintain that children who are hopelessly incurable, that is, who either have congenital diseases or have deeply painful medical or psychiatric conditions, are to be euthanized, otherwise killed. Even if the patient's, the child patient's parents protest, experts, physicians will decide and override the patient's desires.
That's in existence right now.
It is in existence. Go online. If you doubt me, look up Groningen. It's Groningen. We are attempting here in America to imitate the Groningen protocols because Groningen has decided that these children who are chronically ill and who are hopelessly incurable are a burden upon the limited medical time and the limited medical personnel as well as the limited medical techniques. And therefore, what would be fair and gracious and generous is to liberate these children in their own best interests, of course, liberate them from painful life, which is a life not worth living, into beautiful death. Now, everyone was aware of what was happening during the Terry Schindler-Schiavo problem.
Mm-hmm.
People were constantly saying, oh, I would never want to live like that. Oh, let's liberate her from this painful life into beautiful death. That's what the attorney was constantly speaking about. And if you had a chance to read his book, for the moment I've forgotten his name. He agitates me so I have a block for the moment. This dreadful attorney representing Michael Schiavo, oh, Philos is his name, George Philos, wrote a book that is one of the more scary introductions to sustainable medicine, in which he states that he goes into what in essence is a spiritual out-of-body state in which he speaks with the person in the persistent vegetative state, which person asks him to liberate them from life to death, and therefore he goes ahead and does it. And he believes, this George Philos does, that euthanasia is a significant moral and ethical advancement over any cherishing of human life. And therefore, this whole idea of liberating those who want to leave life to beautiful death fits in directly with sustainable medicine.
Sounds like a really scary horror movie.
It really is. And what we've got to understand is that it is happening right now. And if anyone wants to check some of the books by Dr. Daniel Callahan, simply once again, either go online or go to your library, and you'll have the chance to read False Hopes, which has the subtitle Towards Affordable and Sustainable Medicine. And once again, sustainable medicine is known to people in Europe, although it is essentially unknown to Americans, because people in Europe are accustomed to socialized medicine, which has various forms of restrictions, and these restrictions ultimately lead to death.
Well, it also sounds like what you're saying is that as an individual, you have no choice in what you do. And somebody else decides what's good for you or your family.
Right. Therefore, I encourage everyone who has any passion for living and any desire to control what it's done to his or her body to instantly investigate, and then I hope also to set up a health savings account. Because a health savings account will enable you to be free of, say, an HMO deciding that, so sorry for someone of your age and ethnicity, we are not going to allow X when you know that you need X and you and your physician want to provide you with X, but the HMO or the PPO or whatever the organization or the insurance company is going to say, so sorry, not for you. But if you have a health savings account, then you are in charge of what you spend for whatever diagnostics, whatever treatment, and whatever cures you care to have.
Have you had any experience with that?
Oh, absolutely. I know this material very well. I've been working in Washington on this for a good long while. The health savings accounts are magnificent. What they do is to pair a private you could call it a spending account. Let's hypothetically put $3,000 in it. We'll pair that with a high deductible catastrophic insurance policy, which has a deduction of $3,000. So the two work precisely in concert with one another. So you spend from your individual or for a family, you say it's a $5,000 put in that account, and you spend on whatever physician, whatever hospital, whatever treatment, whatever medication you want, your money, it's yours. And then if, God forbid, you have some sort of major crisis, and that would be anything that costs over the $5,000 in the account, then your insurance kicks in and you're covered. But if you're healthy and you are careful and you are prudent, most likely you are not going to spend anywhere near that $5,000. And the money then is yours. It rolls over to the next year. And it's very much like an IRA account. It's your money. It's your life. It's your body. You've got control over all. I like that.
Well, speaking of your body, I understand now, is your book out? Who owns your body, or is it forthcoming?
Well, it's supposed to be out. It's very, very frustrating. It's being published by Prager, this very illustrious, wonderful publishing house, and it's dated 2005, but truly, I've not yet seen it. So Who Owns Your Body? Doctors and Patients Behind Bars is done. It's been complete for about a year and a half, and it's been in production, and we should be seeing it before the end of the year. And every time I inquire, I am told that I'm, in fact, going to be getting a new royalty check, and I've actually earned money on what I've never yet seen.
Well, that's good.
So that's hopeful that it will, in fact, soon appear.
Well, talk about what's in that book.
That book is, in essence, what led me to sustainable medicine. It does not really directly address sustainable medicine, but it deals with the strange change in the law that guides and guards medicine from a gentle, logical, civil law to a vindictive and vicious criminal law, so that the law that guides physicians and surgeons, particularly those who take Medicare reimbursement, this law is so strict and so arbitrary and so in a sense, it's volatile. It changes all the time. 132,000 pages of regulations, some of which are completely contradictory to one another, must be known and followed by every physician in America. And this leads to the likelihood, not just the possibility, but the likelihood that someone will, even when ethical and excellent, violate the rules. But the problem with criminal law is that if one violates a rule, then one is subject to prison and even death, that literally death,
wow,
if one is not only accused but then convicted of a healthcare crime. So physicians and surgeons are in desperate positions, and I've been involved in many of the in the defense of falsely accused physicians and surgeons nationwide, who have been accused by, say, an envious competitor or a disgruntled fired office worker,
mm-hmm.
or even a divorcing spouse,
mm-hmm.
or a particularly obnoxious patient who has accused the physician of, say, providing medically unnecessary surgery. Well, you know, when you think about that, how can something be medically unnecessary and still be fair if the patient asks for it,
right.
the patient gets better, and all is well? What happens, of course, is that medically necessary is now defined under this criminal law as whatever the government will pay for.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't want to pay for it, it says, oh, well, so sorry, it's medically unnecessary, you shouldn't have done it. But as opposed to merely slapping the wrist of the practitioner who has provided the care, the physician is then accused of felonious behavior. And physicians have fewer protections of their constitutional rights than murderers, arsonists, and rapists, and therefore they are in terrible peril. Furthermore, patients are collectivized. That is, any patient who is in what is called a capitation group or whose physician is paid by capitation is merely a head. Literally, caput in Latin means head, so as if a head of cattle or a head of lettuce. One person is equal to every other person. There is no individualization. And the physician is paid per head, whether the head and the rest of the body come for care or not, and whether the head comes with a hangnail or cardiac arrest. The patient comes with whatever he comes, but the physician is paid no more and no less for whatever care he must provide. Therefore, the incentive to physicians is to withhold expensive diagnostic and treatment and surgical care. And it's a vicious system. And the HMOs and some of the PPOs use capitation payments to physicians. So the book, Who Owns Your Body, exposes this criminalization of the physicians and the collectivization of the patients. And fortunately, it is able to celebrate the salvation, the way to get out of all of this, and that is, in my judgment, the health savings accounts and the other attempts to bring medicine to the modern age of capitalism, namely to exchange value for value and to have people pay cash for the best of the best if they want it, and to pay less cash if they want to be more stringent in mm-hmm. their own control of their money and their own control of their bodies. But basically, I maintain, let people choose, let individuals make decisions on what is most important to their lives, and that affects, therefore, their death.
How, for people who, you know, have most of their insurances tied into their work, how do they, can they get out of that and start their own program?
Yes, they can. Now, there are, we've now gone to about 1,200,000 of these new health savings accounts. If any of our listeners want to ask their employers or their human resources groups about health savings accounts, I think they'll find that the answer is sometimes a very enthusiastic yes. For instance, if you now have, whoever is listening, if you now have medical insurance through your employer, or for that matter, if you're self-employed and you have established medical and health insurance, what I recommend is that you ask the employer, or you just ask yourself, to go from whatever you've got to a health savings account. What your employer will discover is that the health savings account, which consists of the two things, one is the health savings account itself, and the other is the high deductible catastrophic insurance, that this combination costs less than regular health insurance.
Can you, because, you know, sometimes we have to hear things a couple of times before it soaks in. One more time.
Sure. Let me suggest that you picture a handshake, two hands, as equivalent hands, so the left and the right, or two right hands of two people, or the two parts of a pair of pliers. Whatever you're picturing, make the two hands or the two parts of the instrument equal. One represents the health savings account itself. It's your money, and let's just for the sake of discussion put in that savings account $3,000 for an individual. We'll put in $5,000 or more for a family, but let's put in $3,000 for an individual. The other hand, exactly equal, represents the high deductible catastrophic insurance policy in which the deduction, the high deductible, is $3,000. So you've got $3,000 in your health savings account and $3,000 as a deductible in the insurance. And they work together as if in this benevolent handshake. The two hands are holding one another in a good, faithful, and friendly grasp. You use for whatever you want. You want to have your examinations. You want to buy your medication. You say you prefer acupuncture as opposed to a particular type of medication. That's your choice. You buy whatever you want in with your health savings account money. It's your choice. It's your body. It's your life. But if you've got a really serious problem, and we'll call that something that costs more than the $3,000 that you've got in the account, then your insurance kicks in and takes over. Most healthy people actually spend less than $1,000 in actual money on their health per year. Therefore, this individual who's got the hypothetical $3,000 in the account will have, say, $2,000 left over. That rolls over to the next year as if it were an IRA account. If the individual is employed, then the next year the employer puts in, or you yourself as the self-employed put in another $3,000, and now you've got $5,000 in the account. Mm-hmm. Again, it's your account. You can invest it prudently. Merrill Lynch, Mellon Bank, many of the big banks and the investment houses now are handling these, because they recognize that they're starting out with a very small amount of money now. But just as the IRAs started with very few thousands, IRAs now are billion-dollar investments. So, too, the health savings accounts, the HSAs, will become so if we handle them correctly. And, therefore, anyone today who is employed and gets medical benefits can get an HSA, presupposing the employer wants to offer this. And most employers are thrilled to offer them because they are so clever. They don't cost more. They generally cost less. But they give the individual freedom. They give the individual individuality, which is wonderful, as opposed to the individual becoming just a mere group member. If any of the listeners want to hear more about this, I recommend that they go online and look at HSA Insider, that's Health Savings Accounts Insider, or HSA Online, or simply type in Health Savings Accounts, and you will find literally millions, not thousands, but millions of hits because health savings accounts are brand new and they're magnificent and they enable us to avoid sustainable medicine. They give us control. They give us the right to choose what shall be done or not done to our bodies.
That's a beautiful thing. Are the physicians becoming more acceptable? Because, you know, they've been so long into this PPO, HMO, whatever baloney.
You're right.
You know, that if you come to them and say, hey, I want to pay cash. Sometimes they look, especially in the office, well, gee, we're not sure we can do that.
Right. And furthermore, many of the physicians will say, cash? I don't know what to do with it. We don't have a cash register. But that's all right. They're becoming far more sophisticated, and there are many people, many physicians and surgeons throughout the country who have decided to simply stop taking insurance altogether. And they are running what are, in essence, cash practices. And there's one particular man, for example, in Tennessee, who has a clinic called Patmos, P-A-T-M-O-S. And it sounds biblical, but what it really means is pay at the moment of service.
And it's beautiful.
And then in California, there's a whole group of simple care or similar physicians and surgeons who have decided that they're going to use only cash or cash, credit card, and check. And this is wonderful. It is a way in which there is dignity, there is a confidentiality between the physician and the patient, and there's no need to send the medical record to some insurance clerk who, after all, should not be practicing medicine because not having a medical degree. And there is a mature and very impressive respect and dignity among the physicians and surgeons and their patients when there is this exchange of value for value. I'm thrilled with it.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time and the awesome work that you're doing. And I was just, that was the highlight of the whole conference for me, was to meet you.
Thank you.
You're just doing some wonderful work, and I want to thank you, and I hope you'll come back and let us know what's going on and stay in touch.
If you invite me, I work with you with joy.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you. Thank you all for joining us this week. Remember, check us out on the web, freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Get the guide. Get the tools. You need them to keep up the fight. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. whether you agree or disagree. Please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome back to our second hour at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. And we're going to continue to talk on subjects of Fabianism and regionalizing England in this circumstance and the European Union with a special guest that we've contacted in England. We're going to compare England with the United States, how the governmental systems are working there to break the boundaries of historic English life. They're raiding the treasury there just as they are here, and they're changing the law and customs of the British society very rapidly. The New World is coming quickly. Now, we quoted Tony Blair's statement last year that all authorities must in the UK adopt local Agenda 21 strategies by the year 2000. We're going to talk some tonight about how Agenda 21 has moved very quickly in England. We can expect the same patterns to follow here. And, of course, I am, as I've explained to the audience before, I was a actual participant in the Santa Cruz County local Agenda 21 meetings back in the 90s. They were very, very bizarre meetings that called for a complete transformation of society, and I think we can see that that process is beginning to roll right out. So while we discuss a global transformation, it's certainly appropriate to compare notes with what's happening and how the good people in America's mother country, England, are faring. And so I'm going to welcome our guest tonight, Englishman Robert Theobald. Robert, are you with us?
Yes, hello, Michael. Thank you. Yes, I'm here.
Well, it's good to hear you. It's the sun has just gone down here in California, and I guess it hasn't quite come to rise.
It's been up for an hour here.
Oh, it's been up for an hour. Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's early there, and it's getting later here, but it's wonderful to have you on the phone.
Thank you, Michael.
Tell us a bit. Now you're with a group called One England, and
One England is actually the name of a group of people that are campaigning against regionalization, the cutting up of England into these artificial regions. That's the name that we gave to our group. In fact, that's our website, oneengland.com.
Okay, and the campaign for an independent Britain. Tell us.
Yes, that's the sort of mother group that I belong to. In fact, I'm on the committee of that group, and we've got around 2,500 members all over Britain.
Wow.
And farther afield as well. But one of the things that we campaign against is the regionalisation of the country.
What do you mean by regionalization, and what effect does it have for the person who's rather new to the subject?
Well, it's been done with a great deal of skill, if you like, by our opposition. For example, the first manifestations of it that you saw were the separation of Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales, and they were the first ones. They had referenda in Wales and Scotland for these for a regional government, if you like. It wouldn't be a government that covered everything, but a great deal of their affairs would be dealt with by this regional assembly.
Okay, so regional assemblies come into place and take authority over this, that, or something else.
It's
outside the scope of traditional government.
Oh yes, it's a different animal altogether. It's in Wales, actually, the assembly there was voted for. They got a small majority for an assembly, but only on a very small turnout of the public. If I remember rightly, it's only about, I don't know, about 40% of the people voted. So just over 50% of them wanted it. So therefore, you've got just over 20% of people actually voted for this assembly.
Well, it sounds, you know, if I'm to compare here and watch the regional organizations that begin to crop up over air, over water, over garbage, over neighborhood associations, over watersheds, over this, over that, and everything, you know, what I find is that they just set them up, or they'll use democracy if they think they can win the election. And, of course, there's a lot of misinformation that's given in the context of that election, but then even when they lose the election, they still find a way to do it anyhow. It's as though a new regionalized system, both here in the United States and apparently in England, is just being ordained by the political leaders of either the right or the left.
Oh, yes. The way that the whole thing is advanced is quite amazing. For example, they try to get an elected assembly here in the east of England, and we've really got an unelected assembly, which is meant to scrutinise the East of England Development Agency, if you like. We've really got the unelected one, but they want to be elected, you see. Now, because that is the instructions from Brussels, actually. That's the diktat, that it should be elected. Now,
so when you say Brussels, you're talking about directives on regionalizations that come from the European Union.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, they wanted to have the thing elected, so that the East of England Regional Assembly elected. So they went through this consultation process, and needless to say, only a few thousand people voted in it, or even bothered to vote out of millions and millions. I think the population of the East of England is about, I don't know, but I think it's about 5 or 6 million. But only a few thousand of those bothered to vote. And only a tiny fraction of those people actually were in favour of the elected assembly. But the way they fixed it, when they published the results, they said that anybody that had even replied to this consultation process, even if you replied and you hadn't actually been in favour, they counted that as an interest in the regional, in an elected regional assembly. So they're all the time they're figuring out ways to advance their project, even though it's opposed by the people.
Wow. And it's the concept again of continental government that is driving the regionalization to break down the nationality of
the idea is to break down your sense of nation. And this is quite bizarre, actually, the they go to now. About a year ago, I think it was, and you can see this correspondence on the One England website. You can see it. The celebrities in our area in the east of England, out of the blue, they received a letter from the regional assembly asking them to be an East England ambassador, in inverted commas. You see, in other words, to go in the press, go in the media, and try to build up this identity of the east of England. And they've already done it. I tell you. They already had a bit of success. Professor Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge, the Lucasian professor of physics, that wrote the book A Brief History of Time. They actually got him into it, and I'm sure he wasn't sure what he was doing, really, but he was brought into that sort of propaganda exercise, and Frederick Forsyth got a letter from them, and you can see Frederick Forsyth reply to the East of England Regional Assembly. It's quite amusing, actually, and if you go on to One England, you should see it there. But that's one of the things they do, and all the time they're trying to create an identity when there isn't really one at all.
Yes. And the methodology then for regionalizing the United Kingdom is, or let's even focus more specifically on England. You have counties.
We do.
Like we do.
Yeah.
What is the effect of the process of European integration on county governments or on the national government itself?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting one, Michael, because we always had the county. Previously, we had the city councils, which would be for the big cities. We had the county councils, town councils, and then district councils within the county, and even down to parish council, which didn't have a lot of power. But anyway, that's the structure.
And these were elected agencies that had certain limitations on their powers.
That's right. Yeah, and then the new system is what they call the unitary authorities. Now, a unitary authority, for example, my town, I live in Luton in Bedfordshire, now that's a unitary authority, which has now got a great deal of extra power over many, many different things. This is the European Union concept. Now, the counties basically are on a slippery slope. They're gradually losing their raisins in the within the county, and even down to parish council, which didn't have a lot of power. But anyway, that's the structure.
And these were elected agencies that had certain limitations on their powers.
That's right. Yeah, and then the new system is what they call the unitary authorities. Now, a unitary authority. For example, my town, I live in Luton in Bedfordshire, now that's a unitary authority, which has now got a great deal of extra power over many, many different things. This is the European Union concept. Now, the counties basically are on a slippery slope. They're gradually losing their raison d'etre, if you like.
Now, is that happening because the people in the counties want to get rid of their government? Is that happening because the parliament wants to get rid of it? Is it happening because Blair wants to get rid of it? Or is it some other force?
No, the people are very, very attached to their counties, actually. It's just that the regional government, this new regional thing, it's all the time it's eroding the county. For example, a county now becomes, or the rump of different counties, become sub-regions of the East of England region, you see. It's a sub-region. It even has a number, you know, like, for example, Norfolk is UKH. They actually give it a letter. That is like something out of science fiction, you know. That's the old county of Norfolk, you see. It's very, another thing, of course, for example, the fire services, they want to, this is a big argument, a big struggle we've got at the moment. In our county, in our area rather, there's 6 fire control centres. That's one for each county. But in the new regional way of doing things, they want to do away with all that and just have one regional control center.
Well, and that's what's happening in America, just to compare the notes. In my county, the goal is to make an integrated water plan that covers multiple counties. And so that parallels that. And at the state level, Arnold Schwarzenegger has called for the elimination of California counties. Now, most Californians don't know that, but it's in his 2,500-page, what do you call it, CPR, California, performance review, and 2,500 pages that include the restructure and further regionalization of California and the elimination of counties. Now, that's exactly what the EU is requiring of Britain if the EU was to predominate, and of course they're not going to give up until they've succeeded unless the American people or the British people just say no. Is that
that's right, but it's such an insidious process then. Because, for example, we've got this East of England Regional Assembly, and I'll just tell you a little bit about that, because you can, that will give you some sort of an idea for all of them. Each of the East of England Regional Assembly has representatives on. Now, if each authority can pay a subscription and then go on to the Regional Assembly. Now, the members that go in there, they're not elected, but you do get some kind of representation, apparently, because the Regional Assembly is now the ultimate source of what they call the spatial planning. Okay, the spatial planning, that's a word we never had before, spatial, because it translates directly from the German word Raum, R-A-U-M, which is, it comes from the, Hitler used to use that word, the Lebensraum, if you remember that.
I don't.
So the Regional Assembly is responsible for this, the complete planning of the whole area. That's the where the houses will be built, roads, airports, ports, waste disposal, wind farms. This is a new thing they're coming up with. They're responsible for all that, and they will decree what's going to happen.
And when you say responsible for that, that means they're the governmental agency,
responsible for
putting the contracts together with the people of their choosing to create those services outside the realm of any kind of free market, genuine free market, or free enterprise system.
It's a much more dictatorial system than we ever had before, Michael.
Okay, well, it's changing the economic framework from free enterprise to a public-private partnership. And our last guest, Terry Hayfield, called those public-private partnership dynamics not fascist economics. He called them Fabian economics. And I think he makes a compelling case that it really is a new and very sophisticated wrinkle. Of course, the newness of Fabians is not. I mean, the Fabians go back to the 1880s, and they come up today with some real strength and power, as you certainly have to be experiencing in England with your Prime Minister Tony Blair having been a former chairman of the British Fabian Socialist Society. So it's not as though they don't have influence, which is what they, of course, they like to pretend, because if the public's eyes, whether it was the British public or the American public's eyes, was on the philosophy and the tactics of the Fabians, we'd wake up quickly and we'd suddenly sever ourselves from the leadership that we have, whether it's the Labour Party or the Conservative Party or the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. They all seem to be working toward the same transformational end, that is, regionalize our population so that the boundaries are blurred, raid our treasuries with Federal Reserve notes and create massive debts, and institute a new form of government to go along with their new form of economics, as they institute a new form of justice which breaks away from English common law and breaks away from the natural law that provides the foundation for American jurisprudence, at least up till this point in time. Yes. It seems to me the parallels are quite overwhelming between what's happening in England and what's happening here in the United States.
Well, I'm talking about law, Michael. We've got this... it's been on the table for some time now. This is the what they call the corpus juris. That's the I believe it translates in Latin as the body of law, and that is the European Union law, if you like. And it's the end of our common law. But as usual in these matters, they don't do it all of a sudden, Michael. You don't wake up suddenly one day and there you have the corpus juris in place of your traditional law. They wouldn't do that because that would be too blatant. They have to chip away at your law bit by bit and change it so that they hope that the ordinary people don't notice what they've done. But these are the things that we've got to be worried about. That's the corpus juris means an end to the presumption of innocence.
Wow, now wait, that's coming from the EU?
Yeah. If accused, it'd be up to you to prove yourself innocent.
Well, that is the end of the era of reason, because the whole concept of reason was predicated on the idea of a presumption of innocence. I mean, otherwise, we're in a world upside down where rulers rule and the rest of us are just subjects.
Yeah. So it's not. It's for you to prove your innocence. Not for the state to prove you guilty, and then obviously an end to the right to trial by jury.
My.
Now, in jury trial, they're already attacking jury trial all the time here. Now, one of the very recent attacks on it, they're saying that in these financial cases, these financial fraud cases, they'll say, now these cases are too complicated for ordinary people to understand. Therefore, we're proposing that there won't be trial by jury in these cases. So that's how they're starting.
Are these criminal trials or civil trials you're talking about?
This is a criminal trial.
A criminal trial where they make it so complicated that ordinary people can't tell the difference between good and evil? I don't quite understand that. That's convoluted.
That's what they've got on the table right now.
From the European Union.
Yeah, it all stems from that, yes.
Now, is this the same concept that the French people voted down?
The French people have always had they've had the Napoleonic law, which is what this basically is, since the time of Napoleon. They've had that. The jury trial is very, very little used in France. It's not customary to have trial by jury. And it hasn't been for a long, long time.
Well, but I've always said about that the rest of the world has a standard to look up to, and I've always been inclined to think that standard is the American standard of justice, and built on the foundation that English people created for us back to the early part of the last millennium. And if that goes away, if we lose our jurisprudence of English common law and post-Declaration of Independence law here in the United States, if we lose that foundation, then there's no standard to which the rest of the world must hold, and that Napoleonic law application could become very, very troublesome indeed for citizens all around the world.
Oh, yeah, this is the law of a controlling elite, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Another aspect of it is the end to habeas corpus.
End to habeas corpus?
Yeah, yeah.
British habeas corpus, that you've got to be charged with a crime before you can be held, would be gone under the European Union, if England joined the European Union and Tony Blair wants you to do that?
Well, the police would no longer have to bring you before a court within 48 hours of your arrest if we had the full corpus juris, which is the aim actually. And the other big thing, of course, is an end to the ban on double jeopardy, where at the moment, if you've been tried and found innocent, that's it, that's the end of the matter. But they want to change that so that they can try you again, you see.
Well, you know, for Americans who don't remember that part of history, that part of the Bill of Rights was easy for us to do because we just copied the British law, which had been held for hundreds of years. So the new world under the European Union or the United Nations or whatever other regionalizing organizations you want to look at would take us back in all of these citizen protecting notions that have evolved out of England over hundreds of years.
That's right. Well, you've got exactly the same thing, and you revere it over there. It basically, in our systems, everything is legal unless there's a law to say otherwise. On the continent, everything is illegal unless there's a law to say that you can do it. It's the total opposite to what the United States and England have got.
My. Well, I do recall the analysis of Fabianism, that the objective was England and the big cherry, the United States, because if you can control those two societies, political and legal systems, you can it's easy to control the rest of the world because the other peoples are already
used to a system of law that can be used against them very readily. And of course, if freedom falls here, tyranny will rise to be a much bigger monster everywhere, because they'll be able to counterbalance it.
It will. Just the day before yesterday, actually, we were having a demonstration outside Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which you probably know has Fabian roots. And there was one gentleman who was a delegate there from Latvia, and we were talking to him, and he said, "What a wonderful country this is," he said, that you can stand out here in the street and demonstrate, you see. Now, we're in danger of losing that, Michael.
In danger of losing that. Yeah. Well, it's about time then that the British people started standing out in front of the Chatham House. Where are the English people? I mean, we certainly hear nothing in the press about what the European Union really is all about, or about what attitudes toward the European Union are. We certainly know that the White House and that the Prime Minister of England both are very supportive of the mm-hmm. European Union. What about the British people? How are they speaking out? How are they reacting? What do you think is going to happen on this globalizing regionalism? That's
well, the English people, they've got a very strong sense of identity, Michael. In spite of everything that's been thrown at them, they've still got a great deal of identity. In actual fact, a strange thing. If you'd have come to Great Britain 10 years ago, you would see some Union flags, the Union Jack that everyone knows. You wouldn't see that many. But if you come to England today, you will be amazed at how many St George flags you see, the cross of St George, which is the flag of England. It's almost as if the people have reacted against what's happening, and they've brought their St George flags out. And you will see them everywhere now. And when, for example, if we ever do a demonstration or anything, and we have our Union flag and our St George flag, you will get all the taxi drivers, you'll get the lorry drivers, they'll all be hooting and honking in support whenever you do that. So we've got a very strong identity, you know, even with in face of all this Fabian socialism that we're having thrown at us.
Of course, from our last hour, to really understand Fabianism is to understand that the methodology that they are utilizing to achieve their global corporate socialist goal is a global capitalism. And we're not talking about free enterprise here. We're talking about public-private partnerships,
yes.
Taking control of all the regions of the world, never mind national boundaries. And of
yes.
course, that's what the European Union was originally designed to do, was to be this economic pact that basically began the taking down of national borders, because you couldn't decide your own trade policy without getting it blessed off by the European Union. This has been the case for some while. And I think the United States is now finding out that through the World Trade Organization, which acts like the European Union in this regard, through the World Trade Organization, we're losing control over our boundaries. You know, when trade isn't determined by a nation, then a nation begins to cease to exist. That is the way you break the boundary in order to gather the riches. And England is a long ways toward that, and that hasn't proven to work well for the people in England, and the people in America aren't faring well either under these so-called free trade international provisions, which aren't free trade at all. They're managed trade through central governing agencies,
yes.
World governing agencies like the European Union and the United Nations and World Trade Organization. So it's a challenge, I'm sure, in England, because it's certainly being a challenge here in the United States for that word to get out, because the press is so consolidated and so quiet on these issues. All we hear about is Michael Jackson and
yes.
and you know, the latest missing person stories on our newscasts, and that doesn't take us quickly down the road to the understanding we need to establish a life that's our own, whether you're living in England or living in the United States, and ultimately personally living anywhere else in the world. When we come back, we want to talk a little bit about the Pathfinder dynamic in England. I think this is something that Americans will find shocking and interesting when they look at their own communities and see that we're beginning the same process that Tony Blair has called the Pathfinder dynamic. But in the meantime, I'm welcome you to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, and I encourage you to check out our guide, easy-to-read guide, Understanding Sustainable Development, Agenda 21, a guide for public officials. You can get that at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website.
Policies, procedures, and laws enacted by local government and non-government organizations in the name of diversity, community, and Earth are diminishing individual liberty, degrading ecology, and threatening human life and happiness in towns across the nation. You've likely already experienced some of the consequences of policies that are approaching full implementation, with little public discourse or voter input. Have you experienced any of the following? Restricted freedom of mobility as you sit for hours in gridlock traffic. Mounting limitations on, or even loss of, your private property. An engineered housing crisis that you're being told must be solved with your money by those who caused it. Loss of parental authority to a government education system that seems to emphasize social indoctrination over education. Transitioning of water resources to regional control by non-elected bureaucrats with subsequent engineered shortages. Heavy influence of international and non-government organizations over local policy, at the expense of representative democracy. You're not alone in recognizing these and other symptoms of our diminishing freedoms. The adverse consequences of collectivist policies and laws enacted by local government bodies are affecting almost every citizen in your town. Many have noticed and are ready to act to advance individual liberty, family autonomy, a vibrant ecology, and a strong economy. They're doing this by turning their individual initiative into local action for national impact. To find out how you can join others to advance freedom, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232. That's freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Welcome back here to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. Some stations haven't rejoined us, but let's pick up with our conversation with Robert Theobald of England, talking about the European Union, regionalization in England, and the association of the Fabian ideology in making these things happen. In dealing with Pathfinder, Robert, give an overview of what the Pathfinder program is.
Well, the Pathfinder program, Michael, is mainly in the north of England, actually. Well, as far as I can ascertain at the moment. But the name, I think there's a clue in the name, Michael. The name gives you the clue. This is just the way to something bigger. Now, we've recently had it in...
Hold on for 1 second here. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show. I'm here with our special guest, Robert Theobald, and we're talking about the Pathfinder program in England, which, as he suggests, suggests something quite big as we're going to find the path. And just what is it that we're supposed to find to the Tony Blair Pathfinder program?
Hello, Michael?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, Pathfinder. Well, it seems to have surfaced very, very quickly, but actually, like all these things, it's been cooking a bit longer than that. Now in Liverpool, they've just started to knock down parts of the old city. These are Victorian houses, and I believe in Liverpool. I was speaking to a friend from Liverpool, and I believe they've got plans to knock down 20,000 old houses in Liverpool area.
Knock down 20,000 houses and do what with the occupants?
Well, that's exactly the, that is the big, that's the question. There was a recent radio program on Radio 4, which I think actually I sent to you. Thing seems to be done in the most authoritarian way. They basically, the those organising the Pathfinder have resolved which areas they're going to knock down, and they will do everything they can to knock those places, to knock those old houses down. And it's just, it's largely an arbitrary thing. Admittedly, there are some properties that are decrepit and in poor condition, but there's also many, many well maintained, very comfortable, pleasant homes, you see.
Well, of course, even a home that's not well maintained is still somebody's home.
That's right.
And my understanding is that 3.4 million homes have been declared to require demolishment in order to, quote, cut global warming.
Yeah.
So this is the reason for knocking these homes down and moving them into privately financed government housing. That means public-private partnerships again, where the government chooses a house builder and they build subject to the government's new green or sustainable building requirements. And then people move in and live under very heavy government-imposed rules. That's the condition for the public-private partnership, is that government gets heavy controls on the rules for which people live there. And so they're knocking down, planning to knock down 3.4 million British homes.
That's right.
In order to put them in this, New World Order housing along rail tracks.
That's right, yeah. What they say, one of the things they say, Michael, is that, oh yes, we can't keep these old houses because they've only a single skin. They're not a cavity wall construction, you see. But of course, some of our finest houses here are only single skin. For example, Buckingham Palace and 10 Downing Street, they're only single skin. But with the modern materials that you've got today available, you can make a very, very fine job of bringing those old houses up to scratch. You've got all the latest materials and techniques, and they can be made very, very, very habitable, very beautiful. And you can cut down on heat loss through insulation and so forth. There's lots of things you can do with those old houses.
Well, and just the thought that the government would take on this kind of expense, the English budget is not much improved from the U.S. budget in terms of the kind of debt and deficits that are being set up.
Yeah.
And so we're blurring the boundaries through regionalization here and there, and we're raiding the public treasury in order to create this government housing where people will live under the thumb of regional government agencies and the rules and conditions that are placed on occupants in these places. And I say, holy smokes, is this a world we really want to put our children into? They talk about saving salamanders for future generations, and I think our focus needs to change, because if this is what's happening in free England, okay, under British rule, and we see the same patterns here in the United States. In fact, we've had the same kind of housing dynamic presented here in the county of Santa Cruz, where people's homes are demolished, they're then rounded into these non-profit housing developments that are partners between the inside developers and the government, and the rules are just atrocious. It's even making the newspaper how uncomfortable a living situation this is for the people who are living there. And the people who run the projects just say, well, people must follow the rules. And this is the world of transformation that we're going into, and we're seeing the pattern with the Pathfinder program in England and the sustainable programs generally here in the United States. Something for everybody to become aware of and to realize that this isn't just a Santa Cruz phenomenon. You know, it's not just a West Coast phenomenon. It's not just an American phenomenon. It's expanded at least to England, and we happen to suspect it goes a lot further than that.
Well, we're just at the beginning of... there's not too much understanding here, Michael, of what is meant by sustainable development, because I'll just pull up a little quotation that I've got from the regional planning the regional planning document that was I'm just putting it up on my computer now. This was about a year or so ago, the draft report for the East of England Regional Plan, and you're going to like this quotation that I give you. It's about sustainability, and I'm just going to try and get this. I just want to give it to you. Oh, right, here. This is directly off the East of England draft planning document. Some policies include reference to the term sustainable in a fairly loose way. We would advise against using this term within policy text, as it is often unclear what is meant by this in the context of the proposals in a policy. Sustainability is a relative term, not an absolute one, as our understanding of it is imperfect.
Wow, now where did that quote come from?
That comes from the East of England draft plan. The document is actually, the title of the document is RPG14.
Well, now, is this a regionalist plan?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that's the East of England Regional Assembly Planning Panel that's prepared that document. There's about four members, I think, in that.
Well, of course, if they have engaged in a regional plan with the directives coming from Brussels, they are part of the global sustainable movement, even though they may try to step away from the language. Here in America, the language is beginning to catch on, you know, so thoroughly that they're going to have a hard time backing away from it, because clearly that quote does summarize exactly what is the case with sustainability. It happens to be whatever it is that the ruling elite or the ruling edict happens to make it be. And some of the people at the local levels are merely acting as agents for these higher tier councils, but they get their little bidding for their own political dynamics and purposes by whatever it is that the ruling elite or the ruling edict happens to make it be. And some of the people at the local levels are merely acting as agents for these higher tier councils, but they get their little bidding for their own political dynamics and purposes by progressing the sustainable concept. And so there's political capital that associates with it, and it's so sad to see this accumulation of personal power to either gain grants or gain political capital by furthering this regionalization, this so-called sustainability concept, which has a plan for the entire world to control the resources, to control the parenting, to control the education of children and to control people and ultimately to reduce our numbers, because at the core of all of this is the idea that people are harmful to the earth. And of course that's about as unreasoned as you can get, and the only time people are harmful to the earth is when they're put in the kind of tyranny this kind of control inevitably leads to. So it's a free world, it's a clean world, it's a healthy world and a happy world, and that's the world that the genuine British American experience wants to target. That's what the ordinary people in England and the ordinary people in America by huge numbers desires for themselves and their children and the posterity. But we've been fooled by this Fabian left-right dialectic that gets us in this constant state of confusion and this constant state of division, so that we go step by step, heading downward into their made-up synthesis, which they call sustainability, and which Al Gore said would be a wrenching transformation of America. Now, he's a big proponent of it. He calls it a wrenching transformation. So what is it we're doing? We're running around to try to get a seat at their shrinking table while all our fellow citizens fall off the back of the wagon. And they fall off the back of the wagon because opportunity is limited when controls like what the European Union wants to do to the people in Great Britain would do to you. And it's really what it is that the Republican and Democratic administrations for the last 20 years here in the United States have been doing with our people. It was even Governor Ronald Reagan who said California needs to change from the horse and buggy era of political boundaries. He said we must regionalize this state. Well, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger that wants to bring that into play. But I think Californians are going to react much like Englanders do. The idea of states is important in the United States. Not as important as it ought to be, but it's still vested into the spirit of the American people. And clearly when the globalization efforts to combine the Americas, northern and southern hemispheres, starting with the northern hemisphere, when that really gets in the push, as the European Union has been in the push, I think Americans are really going to stand up. But the more we know now, the better we are, and the easier the transition, which is why it's so important that the word that we help to try to get out here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is picked up and spread all around.
I think you've got to, I think what's really important, Michael, is that people in America learn from what's happening in Europe, because we're farther down the road than you in many ways. And I think I'm so pleased that over the last few months that we've got in contact with Dr. Stan, who I believe is very close to you.
Yes.
And Dr. Stan Monteith, and now you. And I'm so pleased that we've done that, because you've done a lot of work on the state sustainability, and you've produced that very, very good booklet, the Agenda 21 Sustainable Development booklet. We've got some of those. We've already sent them out. There's not much, as from that quotation, you know, there's not much knowledge of what it actually means. Just yesterday, I got a notice from I got a copy of a letter which I've sent to you, actually. I faxed it to you. We've actually got one of those booklets to Michael Howard. He's the leader of the opposition in the Parliament, and we got one of those presented to him personally, and he sent a letter of acknowledgement for it.
Cool.
So we're getting those books out, and we're widening our knowledge of what that really means. But I think the thing that we can tell you is what's happened here with the attacks on our state, on our nation, and continuing attacks. I think it's so important for us to network with you.
Well, we will continue to do so, and we have a whole big box of more guides being shipped out to you. And if you're listening in America and you haven't seen the guide to understanding sustainable development, you really need to. You can see it on the web, and you can order them in bulk at reasonable prices from us, so that you can circulate them in your community, circulate them to your leaders, because most of the American leaders don't want to join into this program that's going to undo the American experience and leave the world in a state of Napoleon-style type law. I mean, that's what all this is about. And when the United States Supreme Court makes the kind of ruling that I described earlier tonight in the first hour, you can look at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website if you want to see more information, read more information about this enormously important case from the United States Supreme Court that unanimously relegates private property to the status of a poor relation when it comes to protecting American citizen rights. And this is a case decided unanimously, not covered in the press, and really is just a shocking decision. But it evidences the trend that we're seeing in the governments around the world to join in to this breaching of boundaries, raiding of treasury, and the failure to protect the rights of the citizen. And in America, if that falls away, that has just horrible consequences for the world and for the future. And you know, we're hanging by a thread, but we're still hanging. And as Tom DeWeese will talk about at the Reno Convention conference on July 14th through 16th, there is one way we're going to be able to resurrect the American spirit, and that is precinct by precinct. And again, that's why you need to get these guides. So in your precinct, you've got some people who understand what's really happening, because this knowledge is power. You know, if we know what we're fighting and we know how they organize, there's all kinds of weaknesses there. And by sharing the information, as Robert suggests, between the U.S. and the U.K., you know, we can begin to more fully identify the pattern that's coming. Talk to me about the nature of the laws that are coming down in England, where they come from, and how they're being organized.
Well, you know what, Michael? If you go into the House of Commons, and you look up at the TV monitors, which are there all the time. You've got one for the you've got one for the House of Commons, one for the House of Lords. If you look up at the monitors for the House of Commons, you will see so often on that monitor that it's a law, that they're discussing a law that's come down from Brussels, and they have to discuss it and go through the motions of agreeing it, of endorsing it. You see, now about at least 60% of the laws that are passed now are straight from Brussels.
Wow.
And then they pass them through the Parliament. And sometimes they do what we call gold plating here. So they take a Brussels law, and then they even add a bit more onto it. You see, gold plating. So
your law is originating in Brussels.
Yeah, the majority of it comes from over there. Yes, that's right. But they'll never tell you that. The politicians will never say, oh yes, we're just endorsing such and such law that's come down from Brussels. Oh no, they don't say that because they still want to keep drawing their full stipends and wages and so forth, you know. But so they never tell the ordinary people where all this legislation comes from.
Wow. Well, it reminds me of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz's Joan Peros, geopolitical journalist who attended the Sustainable Conference, the UN Sustainable Conference in South Africa here 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And she came back and said she saw the prototype legislation coming out of the UN environmental committees that then she immediately saw here in the state of California. So it's amazing how these global organizations are writing the laws for England, they're writing the laws for California, they're certainly writing the laws for Washington D.C. And so that's another parallel that is largely unknown by the American or British people.
There's a couple of books that I'd like to mention, Michael, while I'm on the air with you. One is a book which was actually printed in 1964 in Australia, and it's The Fabian Socialist Contribution to the Communist Advance by Eric Butler.
Hmm.
Now, that is a book that's full of information about the things that we're talking about, and you can get it from Donald Martin. And I'll give you his phone number in England. It's 44-1787-376-374. That's a very important one. It's just not a long book. It's only got about 60 pages, really. But so full of information. And that's really, although it was 1964, it's bang up. It's very appropriate. The other book that I've just got is by a Frenchman, and that's a fantastic book to look out for. It's Pierre de Villemarest. That's Villemarest. Facts and Chronicles Denied to the Public. I don't know if it's available in the United States. I would think so. The publisher is Aquilion. If you go into the Aquilion website, which is Aquilion. If you go onto that website, I'm sure you'll see how to get that book. But I'll tell you one from that book. Mr. Villemarest is telling us about how the Fabians were directly involved in the foundation of this European superstate, because you had Sidney and Beatrice Webb. Associate of George Bernard Shaw. Then you had Eleanor Marx, one of Karl Marx's daughters, who went over to the United States to establish groups over there. You had Edward Bernstein, who is a German, I believe, and he was the main mover and shaker and Fabian cell in the heart of the German social democracy. He went over to Germany. And the others went over to Hamburg, Brussels, Rome, Paris. And one of the main characters in the formation of United Europe is this man called Count Richard Coudenhove Kalaji. He's got a difficult name, but C-O-U-D-E-N-H-O-V-E-K-A-L-E-R-G-I. That's Coudenhove Kalergi. He was the founder of the Pan-European movement, which of course gives birth to, eventually, to the European Union. Now he's directly associated with the Fabians. So Mr. de Villeneuve talks about that in his book, and it's got so much useful information in there about that. The London School of Economics being a Fabian creation as well. I think that's a very interesting one for people to try and get hold of.
Well, and I would recommend, since we're talking about books, Fabian Freeway by Rose Martin, a 1966 book that reads like the most exciting novel. Every page could be a movie, I'd say, and yet when you realize that this is a documentary, it's a record, it is chilling in the same time. So the key to Fabianism is to, as the local Republican operative said, well, we can't talk about Agenda 21. We know it's there, but if we talked about it, well, we might lose an election. Well, I don't know why they'd lose an election, because when you tell the truth, you're likely to be elected. The truth is that Fabianism has to hide in the shadows, because when the light comes on it evaporates like the Wicked Witch in the Wizard of Oz. And so that's why an increased focus, an increased understanding on Fabian ideology and its mechanisms, creating this artificial dialectic, are so important for more Americans to begin to understand. And of course, if you want to understand it, don't spend $200,000 to go and get a college degree, because you won't learn about it there, that's for sure. Well, we have a few minutes left here, Robert. What would you like to leave us with in these last couple minutes as we wrap up the hour, and on a great end of the day for us and a good start of the day for you?
Well, I think that for me, Michael, I think that the English-speaking peoples throughout the world, we've always been very, very attached to our freedom, and that's here and in the United States, Australia, all the English-speaking peoples. And I think that it's so important for us to network on this. When I say the people, I'm excluding the elites, of course, that are pushing these global agendas. I'm talking about the actual people, and it's important for us to network as much as we can, get this information out that we've got available, and to share it with each other. I think that's a good way to try and get back what we've lost. I don't know if you agree with that.
I do agree with that. I mean, really, it's a battle today, not between left wing and right wing, because the left wing and the right wing is being coordinated to the same end by an ideology. But the ordinary people in America and the ordinary people in England don't subscribe to that. The more they know, the more they're going to unite with each other, because it's about goodwill. It's about respecting each other, respecting our right to parent our children, respecting our right to use and enjoy our property, respecting our right to have a life that's our own. And the good people in England who are born out of the same tradition that Americans are, in terms of our culture and our law and our societal structure, just need to shake off the fog, compare notes with each other, become friends with those you thought weren't your friend, because we begin to recognize that ordinary people have common interests, and those common interests depend upon a societal structure that recognizes the importance of each individual, and that guarantees the system of equal justice as opposed to a system of manipulated social justice. And you know, it's exciting for me to get to know you and